results, and he has the one from last year.
Thanks.
Oh, Elliot's the vice president.
A lot of
kids. He's got about 10 kids recruited to work.
We're here.
Sit down there. Okay.
This is what we have.
Oh, thank you.
Call the Business, Industry, and Jobs Committee to order. We're continuing our discussion on Senate File 481. And we heard the last meeting about 35 or 40 minutes or so from the opponents, maybe a few minutes longer. And we think we'll do it this way. We'll start out with the proponents, probably 50 minutes to an hour, Senator Marty, and then maybe 10 or 15 minutes from there, three or four that didn't get heard at the last meeting, the opponents. So, and then 20 to 12 or so, we'll committee will visit, then we'll probably vote. I guess we will vote, but Senator Marty, welcome to the committee. Senate File 481. You may proceed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Senate File 481 is a bill that would strengthen Minnesota's air emission standards for motor vehicles, for passenger autos and light trucks. And I will be offering later, asking the committee to consider the A8 amendment. I'm not offering that now. It's a delete everything amendment, which basically incorporates everything that the Senate has adopted. Plus, the House author took some amendments that to address some concerns raised by Minnesota Farmers Union, and also some that were offered and requested by Representative Al Junkie, who is not a supporter of this, but the House author accepted them, and I would be I'm willing to accept that, so I'd be offering that or asking somebody to later. But to begin the presentation, Minnesota automobiles, as most of you know, are governed by the federal EPA standards. But we are allowed to have, states have two choices. We can adopt them, or we can adopt an alternative, stricter set, which were adopted by California.
Hold. Okay.
We are just starting a committee. If you could hold until we get to your testimony.
Can you mute?
Thank you.
Thank you. So we, Minnesota and every other state, is given the choice of either the EPA standards or tougher standards, which were developed in California. And California was allowed to do this because when the Clean Air Act was adopted at the federal level, California already had air quality standards. California has been several steps ahead of the federal government ever since then. And much earlier in this decade, they adopted some standards to adopt greenhouse gas emissions standards and added that to the list of standards. They have been very deliberate and cautious in their approach year after year. They give the auto industry a number of years to meet those standards. They've been doing this for a good number of years. The standards they adopted, and I believe in 2002, they gave the auto industry until 2009 to adopt. Other states have chosen to take the stricter standards. Again, we have two choices because the federal government does not want, and understandably does not want, to have auto industry make 50 different types of cars, one for each state. But 14 states now are governed by the standards, the stricter standards. We would be the 15th if we were to adopt this. That's almost half of all the cars sold in the country are going to be under the California standards. Arizona adopted this a few weeks ago. Other states, including New Mexico and some of the East Coast states and so on, have adopted this in the past. Minnesota has often been a leader in environmental protection. We're asking us to be one of the earlier states rather than one of the last states to act. This legislation has been defeated in the legislature here in the past. Auto industry opposition is very strong, but that's not a surprise. They fought against every single standard, whether it's consumer protection or auto safety or environmental standard. Year after year, they give the same excuse. We can't do it. It's not technologically feasible. It's going to cost consumers an arm and a leg. It's going to take away their choices. But every time, the auto industry has been wrong. Every time they've been able to do it. A lot of the technological advances have been driven by federal and California air emissions standards in the past, and it's not like they're not on board with them now. The California Air Resources Board director, who was here a few weeks ago. He meets regularly. They meet almost a monthly basis with the engineers at the automakers, and they are telling them, well, why aren't you working this way? And they negotiate with them. So the standards that are in place for 2012 and 2016, the auto industry is fully aware of, and they will meet those standards as they've met the other ones in the past, always kicking and screaming, but always meeting the standards and making better cars as a result. While we've lost on this bill in the past, the tide is beginning to turn. As auto is fuel prices go up, consumers are beginning to demand more efficient cars. And the governor's Climate Change Advisory Council, which met until a couple of months ago, they came out with a recommendation that we adopt this legislation. Why do we want to adopt this legislation? I'll give five reasons. First of which is it significantly reduces greenhouse gas emissions. The standards in this bill would reduce the emissions by 40% to 45% more than the federal government standards would between now and 2020. And when we passed the greenhouse gas emissions standards last year, we put some very heavy burdens on the utilities. We put some heavy burdens on. They're going to meet them. They know. They were part of the negotiations. They're going to meet them. But if we let the auto industry, which is about a quarter of our air emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, if we let them off the hook, we're going to be pushing harder on other sectors of the economy to meet those standards. So the main reason we want to do this is to reduce auto emissions, including greenhouse gas standards. The second reason, it does save consumers money at the pump. Reducing greenhouse gas emissions does make motor vehicles more efficient. If you were to buy Minnesota cars and trucks with these standards today, the estimated savings at the current price of gas, about $340-something, would be about $4,000 over the life of a car. The cost of meeting the 2012 standards is actually about $520 in more expensive car costs. But from day one, your monthly car payments would be significantly overwhelmed by the savings in fuel consumption. And so at today's prices, the average savings over the life of your car would be about $4,000. You would meet the 2012 standards, payback is less than 1 year. You'd meet the 2016 standards in about 2 years at gas at the current price. If gas hits $4, if it hits $5 over the next 7-8 years, the savings will be significantly greater than that. The third reason for passing them is to avoid the problem of possible clean air non-attainment. If we fall into, which we've been on the edge of, I don't think we're in big danger of falling off edge. Remember the vehicle emissions testing stations that we all did not like. If we lose federal compliance, we will have them back again. The Chamber of Commerce, I think, has estimated that their cost to business, if we lose our attainment standards, is about $200 million. These are all things we're not sure we're going to have them. We hope we don't have them. This bill will virtually guarantee we will not have to meet those standards because we will not fall off emissions non-attainment if we pass this bill. So we will prevent those possible risks, which would be a heavy hit on the economy. And again, as one who remembers going through those emission testing stations every year, I think our constituents were not very fond of that either. The fourth reason is it does improve the health of Minnesotans by preventing air pollution. Outside of greenhouse gases, there are about 300,000 Minnesotan adults and 100,000 children with asthma, which is exacerbated by smog. This reduces the air toxics that cause smog by about a quarter. And finally, this will help us reduce our reliance on foreign oil by the fuel savings that we make. The bill has been through three committees in the Senate and five or six committees in the House, and it's had a lot of misinformation presented over and over again. Among the main ones we keep hearing is it will reduce the availability of trucks and bigger vehicles. California was required under its law, the standards that they set were required to be able to be accomplished with the current mix of vehicles, the current weight, the current size, the current power of the vehicles. What they are doing is not downsizing to meet standards, not saying everybody's got to drive a Prius. They're saying if you're going to drive a Ford Explorer, that Ford Explorer has to be more efficient engines. And it does accomplish that. I think in your packets you have this impressive picture, not a vehicle I'd be encouraging people to have, but of a Hummer which, if it's on E85, is currently certified to meet the California standards. I think you may also have a GMC 2008 Sierra 1500. That one, again, if it's driven on E85, already meets the standards. This does not change the size of vehicles required. That's been stated over and over again. The industry keeps claiming that that's not the case. Everybody's going to be driving small cars in Minnesota. And they say our mix of vehicles is much different than California, and that's true. So is New Mexico. New Mexico is a ranch state. I mentioned them earlier. The reason I mentioned them is they have a higher percentage, higher proportion of trucks than we do. And they meet the standards. They're confident they can meet the standards, and we are as well. They use better technology, which again means if you're going to be driving Chevy Suburban, you'll be driving one that's going to save you a lot of fuel compared to what your Wisconsin neighbors would be driving. The standards, the second issue we've been hearing a lot of confusion about is that these were going to affect current vehicles. These only apply to motor vehicle model year 2012 or later, no existing cars and trucks. It does not require these emission testing statements. It's more likely if we don't, we're going to get the emission testing statement stations. This simply deals with future cars and trucks. We've been told many times this destroys ethanol or hurts ethanol or other things. The Minnesota Farmers Union was one of the groups that was originally concerned about this. They're now supporting the bill. Frankly, farmers like to be able to drive. If they have to drive big vehicles, they like them to be more fuel efficient as well because they're stuck with the same prices that everybody else in Minnesota is paying these days. The California standards explicitly provide credits for flex fuel vehicles when using E85. It actually provides an incentive for more widespread use of E85. The auto industry lobby's misinformation has been so extreme. I had one really angry constituent contact me saying that my proposal was going to kill street rods, the modified classic cars that we all watched and went out there and visited them all. I think they've later learned they are now officially neutral on the bill because they learned it didn't really affect their vehicles. This constituent also told me that the bill would ban many chemicals and paints, as well as wood-burning stoves and fireplaces, and he was getting this information from the auto industry. Well, California has standards for all those things, too, so maybe if we do this, somehow it'll tie into that. It has absolutely nothing to do with any of that. There's been a big claim that this is going to hurt Minnesota auto dealers. That's also not true. I think we all recognize auto dealers in Minnesota and around the country are hurting. They're hurting a lot. They're having trouble selling cars. With gas prices going up, they're having even more trouble selling big cars. This bill does not take away from Minnesota dealers. Matter of fact, every Minnesotan would have to buy these cars that are sold by Minnesota dealers, which guarantees them our share of the market. I suppose you could go to California or New Mexico or New England and buy a car there, but otherwise you have to meet a car that meets the standards after 2012. Which means you'd be buying from a Minnesota dealer. So they don't lose any business here. What about Wisconsin customers coming over the border to get them here? Well, if you're going to buy Ford Explorer, and you can buy one in Wisconsin, it may cost you $500 less than if you buy it in Minnesota, which means your car payments are, what is it, an extra $7, $10 a month, and your monthly fuel savings are $35 or $40. You might choose to buy in Minnesota, and frankly, I think a lot of Wisconsin and Dakota and Iowa residents may choose to buy their cars here. But I suppose we're still going to hear the complaint that it hurts Minnesota auto dealers. They've been told so by the auto manufacturers that unless they do this, that they won't be able to get them. They just won't sell Ford Explorers in Minnesota or Suburbans or any large vehicles. But the point is they have and they will, and the auto industry is not foolish. Well, they fight all these standards and have made some bad moves. Because of that, they nonetheless are going to sell what people want to buy. And if people want to buy big vehicles, they will sell big vehicles. We are not forced into adopting all the California standards forever. What if California board, which we have no control over, I would say we have no control over the EPA. We can say, well, we've got authority over it because we elect people who have control over it. California could adopt some standards in the future that we may not like. If so, we are free to jump back to the federal standards. We cannot pick and choose. For the most part, you adopt all of the California standards or all the EPA standards. We cannot pick and choose, but we can jump back to the other ones. Would we have time to do that? Yes. When California proposes them First of all, they've been working with the industry ahead of time. Despite the industry's complaints, they are meeting with them on a very regular basis. And California may sometime choose to make some foolish decisions. Again, in 2002, when they adopted, I think it was 2002 or 2003, they adopted the greenhouse gas emissions standards. They gave till 2009 before anything started taking effect. It requires EPA waivers, which takes time. And there is it's designed with a 3-4 year lead time in the process. So if they were to adopt a standard we did not like, if they had something so onerous that we thought was going to destroy Minnesota dealers or ethanol industry or anything else, we could opt out at any time. And I can guarantee you, given the difficulties this bill has had making it through the process, there would be lots of people eager to move backwards if we chose to do so. But in 30 or 40 years, California has not been wrong once on their fuel efficiency, on their auto emissions standards. They have not been wrong once. The federal government has copied them, not the other way around. We've been a leader, in summary, we've been a leader in environmental protection many times in the state. We would not be the first or the second or the third state. We would be the 15th if we adopt it this year, probably be the 25th or so if we adopt it next year. Minnesotans care about the future. We care about our grandkids and their grandkids and their grandkids. And with environmental issues and greenhouse gas issues of such concern, I think it's time to act now. And so I'm urging your support for this. I do have that A8 amendment. If somebody wishes to author it, that would. Again, as I said, it's a delete everything amendment. I couldn't vouch for exactly what is changed in it. I know there are plenty of witnesses who can, but this adopts all the language we've had in the Senate and tacks onto it the concerns, addressing the concerns of the Farmers Union and Representative Al Junkie, which was, I believe, ethanol related particularly. And so I would encourage your consideration of that. And then the first witness I would call when you're ready for it is Jim Urkel.
Well, I think we can move the amendment to get it in the shape that Senator Scheid moves the A8 amendment. It would be working off of the A8 amendment entirely, right? Yes. Okay. On the Scheid amendment, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Mr. Urkel, thank you for coming, and state your name and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jim Urkel. I'm an attorney with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, and I direct MCEA's Land Use and Transportation Program. I also served on the Transportation and Land Use Technical Working Group of the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group. The technical working group proposed, and the advisory group accepted a recommendation that Minnesota adopt California's clean car standards. I'd like to start just with a quick reminder of what climate change may mean to Minnesota. It's predicted that Minnesota will experience a 2 to 4 degree Fahrenheit increase in temperature in a do-nothing scenario moving forward. This is the difference between the average temperature, annual average temperature in the White Pine Forest of Itasca State Park, and the prairies of Monoman County, about 50 miles west. It's the difference between the average annual temperature in the Boundary Waters and the Twin Cities. More particularly, it's about the same average temperature difference between the Twin Cities and Omaha, Nebraska. That's right. You know, we won't be a cold Omaha. We will be Omaha. The problem with that kind of temperature difference is that it creates a number of problems for both Minnesota's forests and farms. One of my aunts is fond of telling me that minus 40 below keeps the riffraff out, and in Minnesota's forests, that's really true. There are lots of invasive species of pests that are waiting to move into Minnesota's forests. As it warms up, that will happen. It will have a devastating effect on Minnesota's forestry and the forest economy. In addition, that temperature difference will mean a loss of soil moisture for Minnesota's farms, which will equate to lower yields in the ag economy. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change estimated that doing nothing at all with that kind of temperature difference coming will end up costing about 10 to 20% of gross domestic product. Now, that's internationally, but we can think of the same kind of effect in Minnesota. However, it's estimated that the cost of mitigating some of that will only take about 1 to 2% of gross domestic product. The really good thing about the Minnesota Clean Car Standards is that it represents the low-hanging fruit that we can use to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in a way that actually saves money for Minnesota, improves the economy, provides additional jobs, and increases personal income. Now, I'm going to talk about the economic impacts in a little more detail in a moment, and I know that we have someone on the phone from the Northeast who will talk in more detail about the individual savings. I want to talk about three main issues. The first is how and why the California Air Resources Board developed the standards and as part of that deal with the economic impact to the state. Second, how those standards will impact the use of ethanol. And then third, look at the states that have adopted the standards that Minnesota is considering. In order to do that, I'll try and unbundle some of the criticisms that have been directed at the California Resources Board as well as the Clean Car Standards as I go along. I mean, one of the biggest ones, is that what you're looking at is tens of thousands of pages of regulations that would come down on Minnesota, and that's not quite accurate. This is 109 pages of California's low-emission vehicle regulations. Only a portion of this actually apply to new model years because most of the rest of the regulations deal with model years that have come up through model year 2009. It also includes a number of provisions that we are not proposing that be adopted, such as the zero-emission vehicle mandate. And in fact, here's the regulatory order from CARB dealing with the greenhouse gas emission standards specifically. It's 21 pages long. And again, most of that deals with, or a good share of that deals with ZEV. And I know I'll get around to the adopting states, but here are about 11 pages of regulatory text that Arizona adopted just earlier this month in order to adopt the California Clean Car Standards. Now, one of the other questions is you know, it's going to affect all kinds of vehicles, and Senator Marty referred to this, and that argument requires a certain amount of deliberate density on the part of the opponents because the regulations themselves apply to passenger cars, light-duty trucks. Those are very well-defined. They deal with new models coming down the road, not existing models. It doesn't take into account and doesn't deal with motorcycles. It doesn't deal with the hot rods. All of that is excluded, as Senator Marty pointed out. CARB has the regulatory authority and does look at those under other provisions. There's no reason why they would try and pull these up. There's no desperation move that would make them want to pull it up because they have other sections under the Health and Safety Code in California that allow them to do that. This is strictly about passenger cars and light-duty trucks and medium-duty vehicles, and those are well-defined in the regulations. Now, as to why we should be following California, this is usually teamed up with a question about the number of cities in California that are still subject to serious air pollution problems, and so that somehow the California Air Resources Board is somehow ineffective. California has been regulating mobile source emissions since 1963. That's 45 years. It's been regulating. They were regulating them before there was an EPA or a Clean Air Act. A recent National Academy of Sciences study has shown that California mobile source standards has served as a model for EPA's regulations, and recent studies have also shown that their low level two standards are even stronger and more protective of public health than EPA's tier two standards, which apply nationwide. The National Academy of Sciences also found that California's technology forcing regulations have benefited public health throughout the nation. And as to continued air pollution, that is certainly a point. And if you go to one of the most challenging regions in the country, the South Coast Air Basin, you will see that there are a number of days where the national ambient air quality standards are exceeded. But based on EPA's regulations, the number of days that exceed those standards has dropped by two-thirds since 1980. At a time when the number of days that we exceed those standards has been slowly inching up in the Twin Cities. So in the most challenging of environments, CARB's regulations are effective, and they're improving public health every day. One of the other criticisms is that CARB is a bunch of unelected bureaucrats. And, well, you know, they are an 11-member board. They're appointed by the California governor. But five of them must be elected members or elected officials representing air pollution control districts around the state. They also include PhDs, two MDs, and several business owners. The PhD, in fact, is one of the nation's leading experts on automotive engineering from the University of California. And that stacks up quite nicely with our Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, which doesn't have the same kind of requirement for geographic balance or issue representation. And moreover, CARB hasn't had the PCA's problem, at least before Commissioner Brad Moore, of having commissioners who had lobbied for regulated industries and who seemed to think that their role at PCA was protecting former employers from inconvenient truths like groundwater contamination. One of the other issues is that's been brought up is that CARB is somehow running amok, that they've gone out and simply arbitrarily decided to take care of these or issue these regulations. That's not the case. CARB only started looking at these regulations once the California legislature itself, representatives and senators like you, told them to go out and reduce greenhouse gas emissions from mobile sources. The California legislature understood that they had the same problems with their forests and farms from the impact of climate change. They knew that 40% of their greenhouse gas emissions came from mobile sources. They told the California Air Resources Board to adopt regulations that would achieve the maximum feasible and cost-effective reduction of greenhouse gas emissions for motor vehicles. The legislation defined that term as meaning capable of being successfully accomplished within the time provided, taking into account environmental, economic, social, and technological factors, and economical to the owner or operator of a vehicle, taking into account the full life cycle cost of the vehicle. In developing the regulations, the legislature required the board to consider technological feasibility, provide flexibility in the means by which the regulations could be met, grant credits for steps taken by manufacturers to reduce greenhouse gas emissions prior to the date the regulations took effect. More importantly, the board could not require, or the legislature told the board that they could not require any mandatory TRIP reduction measures or land use restrictions or impose additional fees or taxes on vehicles, fuels, or vehicle miles traveled, or limit or reduce speed limits, ban any category of vehicle, or consider any reduction in weight vehicles. The breadth and detail of this direction belies the claims by manufacturers that the board is unchecked and running amok. To set the emission standards, the board worked with automotive engineering experts to model the reductions for five different vehicle types: small and large cars, small and large trucks and SUVs, and minivans. Once they looked at those, they went and picked specific models based on the manufacturer that had the heaviest fleet of those kinds of vehicles. They then took technology packages off the shelf, started mixing and matching them, and then figured out what kinds of reductions were possible from those technology fixes. What they came up with was a two fleet-wide averages, one for passenger cars and light-duty trucks, those trucks that weigh up through 3,750 pounds. It starts at 323 grams per mile and drops down to 205 grams per mile in model year 2016. For the larger trucks, light-duty trucks two and medium-duty passenger vehicles, it started at, I think, 405 grams per mile and ramped down to 332 grams per mile. That means that the larger trucks got to end in model year 2006 at a level that the passenger cars had to start at in model year 2009. So these are separate fleet averages for based on weight of the vehicles. And it was because it's a fleet-wide average, every model, no model had to absolutely meet those standards. They could be more emitting or less emitting, and it was going to be the average of them. So you could flex that way. You could also flex between the fleets. So if you did a better job on the light duty or on the passenger cars, you could use those credits and offset higher emission from the higher or the heavier fleets. So that's how that worked. One of the other things that the legislature asked was that a full-blown economics study be done, and that was performed by CARB with the help of economists at the University of California. They did a full-blown input-output model for the entire state, and they found that based on the regulations and how they would ramp in, that the state would gain 55,000 jobs because of these regulations, and annual personal income would increase by $5 billion a year. And that number actually was cranked on an assumption that gas would cost $1.74 a gallon in 2016. So you can roughly decide that it's going to be something more substantial than that. Minnesota would be able to see the same kinds of gains in a proportionate manner. The second issue that I wanted to address was the question of ethanol. And really, in order to understand that, you need to understand that there is what's called out in the industry an ethanol wall. There's a lot of production that's coming online, yet the amount of ethanol that can be sold is limited by the blends that exist today, for the most part E10 blends, and the very small market for E85 out in the real world. Right now, and one of the problems has been that California has been criticized as somehow being mean to ethanol. And I think part of this comes from the fact that when they were looking at how to deal with oxygenating gasoline, they went first with MBTE rather than ethanol. They learned from that mistake. They went with ethanol. They have a blend of E5.7 right now instead of E10. But the state of California has been looking at alternative fuels. They have a plan to ramp up their alternative fuels and to build up their biofuels industry. As part of that, the California Air Resources Board issued a resolution last June, I believe, that will move California to an E10 blend by the end of 2009. That represents an additional 600 to 800 million gallons a year of ethanol. That seems like something of a commitment to ethanol. And if you look at the sheet, I included both ethanol consumption and ethanol production numbers on the states that have already adopted or are considering adopted the California standards. And I think one of the things that you'll find is that that 600 to 800 million additional gallons for moving from E5.7 to E10 basically is more than the commitment that Minnesota has based on all of the capacity coming out of all of its ethanol plants today. That represents a commitment to ethanol, one that is just as good and is just as solid as Minnesota's. There's a question of that it might have an impact on Minnesota's move to E20, and CARB has said that it has absolutely nothing to do with the move to E20. Professor David Kittleson from the University of Minnesota has testified that he can't figure out any reason why adopting the California standards would have any effect on Minnesota's ability to move to E20. He has talked to his counterparts around the country, and they have, and he has responded that none of them have any idea how it could possibly affect the move to E20. If E20 is the standard, and if it's approved, and if Minnesota gets the waiver for your E20, then new cars will be able to meet that standard. The last question is really on the use of E85, and the problem is that under the existing CAFE standards, manufacturers have been given a credit against the existing CAFE standard for selling flexible fuel vehicles that can burn E85. The problem is they get the credit whether the vehicles burn E85 or not. That's considered something of a fraudulent loophole by a lot of people, including NHTSA, or the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. They have pointed out that of all the flexible fuel vehicles that are on the road, less than 3% ever taste any E85, and only about 1% ever run regularly on it. As a result, they decided in the new CAFE standards that were passed as part of the energy bill in December of 2007 to ramp out and wink out that credit. So between now and 2020, that credit will be eliminated, basically because it hasn't been shown to actually work in promoting the use of E85. On the other hand, in contrast, the CARB rules say that manufacturers will get a credit based on the upstream reduction of greenhouse emissions based on that fuel for using E85 as long as E85 is being used. And they have provisions for alternative compliance mechanisms that will allow that to be proven up. The manufacturers have said that they have no way of being able to figure that out. Yet they admitted in a 16-day trial in U.S. District Court in Vermont last year that the OnStar or the onboard diagnostics do keep track of or can keep track of ethanol content, and GM's OnStar system has the ability to email that kind of information to anybody that wants it. Now, in terms of whether or not people want to see that happen in their cars or not, that's fine. CARB has suggested that all that's needed is a statistically valid survey of EA5 users in order to be able to prove up the credit. They don't need everybody. They just need some. And the manufacturers are supposedly experts on selling vehicles with all kinds of incentives. And how hard would it be for them to say, well, you know, we'll sell you this new car. It's going to, you know, the interest rate on the deal is going to be 3%, but we'll give you a 1% difference if you agree to allow your onboard computers to email your ethanol use to somebody in a completely anonymous way. They have said in court and admitted that that's entirely possible. And So it's very hard to understand exactly how ethanol would end up being a problem under this. One of the things that has been pointed out is that we have so many more flexible fuel vehicles here in Minnesota than in California. But it's sort of like lying with statistics. You know, as a percent, that's certainly true. But when you look at exact numbers, the Department of Commerce, was reported in MinPost.com just yesterday that there are 170,000 flex fuel vehicles in Minnesota. There are 350,000 in California. California is not going to do something to flexible fuel vehicles when they know it's required for their biofuel plans, for their alternative fuel plans, and to meet their greenhouse gas standards. They're not going to do something that's going to mess that up. And as a result, I think you will see that additional cars will come down the pike. And one last thing is that back during that 16-day trial, there was an argument that they couldn't even get 885 vehicles be certified, yet they admitted it, on cross-examination that they could. Then it became, well, we can't get them certified as super ultra-low vehicles because of evaporative emissions. They don't actually need to be certified as SULEV. They get credits for being ultra-low emission vehicles. More than 50 different vehicles have been certified as ULEV for model year 2009. And the picture that you just saw of the Hummer 2 on May 8th was May 8th, the California Air Resources Board certified the Hummer 2 as a super ultra-low vehicle. So if Hummer can do it, I can't see why Chrysler, Ford, Dodge, or any of the others couldn't either. And so I have the executive order that shows the SULEV designation, and I'd ask that it be passed out.
Senator Marty, we got about 20 minutes to go on your side.
And so, we have Coralie Cooper from NESCOM, which is the Northeast States Coordinated Air Use Management, a number of New England states that work together on air quality issues, and they've have, I believe, all or most of those states have adopted the California standards, and I believe she's on the phone to testify.
You may go ahead.
Okay. Well, thank you and good morning. My name again is Coralie Cooper, and I'm Transportation Program Manager at the Northeast States for Coordinated Air Use Management, and I'll refer to that as NESCOM. And NESCOM is an association of the air pollution control programs in 8 states in the Northeast. Our members include Connecticut, Maine, Massachusetts, New Jersey, New Hampshire, New York, Rhode Island, and Vermont. And NESCOM is located in Boston, and we provide technical support and policy guidance to our member states on matters related to air pollution. We were formed in 1967 by the New England governors. So thank you for inviting me to provide testimony today. I'd like to give the perspective of states in the Northeast that have up to 15 years experience implementing the California Low Emission Vehicle Program. I'm going to speak about 3 main points. First, the benefits the Northeast states see in the California vehicle standards. Second, the technical feasibility of the standards. And third, practical issues related to implementation. But first, I'd like to briefly summarize for you really the most important points of my testimony. And these are, in the 15 years of implementing the California Low Emission Vehicle Program in the Northeast, the program has been straightforward and, I will say, easy to implement. Consumer choice has been enhanced rather than limited, and the Northeast vehicle fleet is among the cleanest in the nation. In the Northeast, we have not had any violations of the vehicle emission standards by any manufacturer to date, and we anticipate that going forward, our experience with the program will be the same. The vehicle fleet will continue to be among the cleanest in the nation, public health will continue to benefit, and consumers will have access, and even preferential access, to the full spectrum of vehicles on the market. So now I'll provide a little detail to support these points, and if it would be helpful, I can also provide transcripts of testimony from Northeast State Environmental Commissioners on some of these issues. So first, what benefit do the Northeast states see in the California program? States in our region have estimated the smog-forming emissions reductions that will be realized from the California Low Emission Vehicle Program using accepted emissions modeling tools developed by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. EPA has subsequently reviewed Northeast state estimates and has approved emission credits to be included in states' air quality planning processes. The states estimate that smog-forming pollution will be reduced 16%, which is equivalent to 40 tons per day in our entire region, and that's over and above what the federal program will reduce. The Northeast states have also estimated greenhouse gas emission reductions that will be achieved by the California program, and more recently have evaluated California's analysis of how the new federal CAFE standards compare with the California program. Our states have concluded the California program will offer greenhouse gas emission reductions over and above the federal program. These reductions will help states achieve the greenhouse gas emission targets established by legislatures and governors. In addition to smog-forming pollutants and greenhouse gases, the California Vehicle Program also reduces toxic pollution for motor vehicles, such as benzene, which is known to cause cancer. So I've talked about emissions modeling, but let me provide a more tangible example of the emissions benefits of the California Vehicle Program in the Northeast. We see now that 25% of new vehicles sold annually in our region are so-called super ultra-low emission vehicles, and Jim Urkel referred to those vehicles as well. And these come with 150,000-mile emissions-related warranties. In much of our region, the air coming out of the tailpipe of these vehicles is cleaner than the ambient air. The high percentage of super clean vehicle sales in the Northeast represents a profound shift in our region toward the cleanest vehicles available in the nation. And Northeast state consumers also benefit from the longer warranty. Excuse me. Sorry about that. My second point, technical feasibility. In 2004, a sister organization of NESCOM, it's called NESCAF, but it's staffed by the same staff as staff NESCOM, published a report on the technical feasibility and costs of reducing motor vehicle greenhouse gas emissions. And I'll just give a little bit of context here. The report was described in the 2008 U.S. Department of Transportation CAFE proposal in the following way, and I quote, "This report," meaning the NESCAF report, "utilized by the California Air Resources Board for their 2004 regulatory action on vehicle CO2 emissions, includes a comprehensive vehicle simulation study undertaken by a world-recognized leader in automotive technology and engineering. The 2004 NESCAF report provides a scientifically rigorous estimation of the synergistic impacts of applying multiple fuel economy technologies to a given vehicle," end quote. And I quote the U.S. DOT here just to provide context for my comments on technical feasibility. So the 2004 report that DOT summarized in their recent proposal concluded that currently available technologies such as turbocharging, six-speed automatic transmissions, improved tires, cylinder deactivation, lane direct injection, and these are mostly fully commercial technologies, can be used to meet the greenhouse gas emission reduction targets established by California. Our analysis showed that emission reductions similar to what California is requiring between now and 2016 can be met without the use of advanced technologies such as hybrid electric vehicles like the Toyota Prius. And since the publication of the study, automakers have announced dozens of vehicles that include these commercially available technologies. And some examples are the Ford Explorer America with turbocharging and downsizing, the Chevrolet Silverado with integrated starter generator, the Chrysler Hemi with cylinder deactivation, the Toyota Matrix and Honda Accord with variable valve lift and timing. So these are just a few examples. There are others. Short, the greenhouse gas standards are technically feasible, and the technologies to meet the standards are here today in the market. In addition, the California standards were carefully designed so that automakers could phase in technologies while still meeting their product planning requirements. In addition, as Jim also mentioned, California created separate greenhouse gas standards for cars and pickup trucks so as not to put undue pressure on manufacturers of trucks or to cause a shift in the vehicle fleet from trucks to cars. Now, and I just want to say a word on cost, because our report did also look at costs. When we did the study, we used a $2 a gallon gasoline estimate. So over the life of the vehicle, which assumed 150,000 miles, we found that a car like the Taurus, an owner would save between $400 and $1,100 over the life of the vehicle, depending on which technologies were included. And today, if we do that analysis again with $3.70 a gallon gasoline, the same consumer owner, a Taurus, would save between $7,000 and $5,000 over the life of the vehicle in reduced gasoline costs. Somebody owning a GMC Sierra-type vehicle at $3.70 per gallon of gas would save between $3,000 and $8,000 over the life of that vehicle in reduced gasoline purchases. Those are two examples. Now I want to move away from the greenhouse gas standards and talk about technical feasibility of standards to reduce smog-forming pollution. And as I mentioned earlier, manufacturers have not had any issue in meeting the California standards in the Northeast, even given that some of our states have a high percentage of light trucks, such as Maine and Vermont. And this has also been true as the Northeast states have phased in the zero-emission vehicle requirements of the program, which are more technology-forcing or require greater leaps in technology development than do the greenhouse gas standards. So because of, for these reasons, we think going forward, we don't anticipate any issues with noncompliance in our states with the California program. Now, on my third point, practical issues related to implementation. States in the Northeast have found that the California program is easy to implement, as I said in the beginning, and it's also one of the most effective air pollution control programs. Early on in the program history, in the early 1990s, cross-border sales were briefly an issue, but once EPA changed its cross-border sales policy, the issue was resolved. And EPA changed the cross-border sales policy to allow federal states, like New Hampshire — New Hampshire is a state that doesn't have the California standards in our region — to sell California-certified vehicles into Maine, Massachusetts, and Vermont, who all share a border with New Hampshire. So, in effect, if a dealer in Massachusetts is looking for, say, a blue F-150 for a customer, the dealer can look contact other dealers in New Hampshire to find that vehicle. And likewise, if a New Hampshire dealer is looking for a specified model, color, or engine type, the dealer could look in Maine, Vermont, or Massachusetts for the vehicle. So there aren't restrictions on trading vehicles if they're bordering a low-emission vehicle state. So we have not had any cross-border sales issues for over a decade, even though we have many federal states that border our region and one within the region, New Hampshire. And in addition, we have not had issues with people buying federally certified vehicles out of state and bringing them into a low-emission vehicle state. Many of our states have put in place a program called registration denial, and that's the ability to deny the registration of a vehicle that is not California certified. However, not all states in our region have registration denial, and Maine is an example. And Maine wanted to find out over the last couple of years if the lack of registration denial is causing a lot of federally certified vehicles to be registered in their state. So they conducted an audit over a two-year period of every single car that was registered in the state. And the Maine state officials found that of the 120,000 vehicles registered over the two-year period, only 9 were not California certified. So they concluded that, this is not an issue for their state. With regard to consumer choice, consumers in the Northeast have continued to have available to them all makes and models available in other parts of the country. And I'd add that Northeast state consumers really have greater access to advanced technology vehicles such as hybrid electrics, which have been in the Northeast and California preferentially to meet the zero-emission vehicle requirements. Thus, the California program, rather than restricting access to vehicles, we believe has improved it for Northeast residents. And last, states have at times been concerned about being reliant upon California's motor vehicle regulations, tying our cart, so to speak, to the California horse. But as states have gained experience with the program and the expertise of the staff in California, this concern has faded. And further, states can and have opted out of the California program and have returned to the federal program without much difficulty. Connecticut actually did this in the mid-90s and actually has now returned to the California program. So adopting the California program doesn't mean that a state must remain in the program. And to conclude, I'll say that the California program is a very important strategy in the effort to improve air quality and reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The program is reducing emissions, improving public health, and providing the cleanest cars in the country to consumers in the Northeast. And we have no doubts that the program will continue to deliver these important benefits in the decades to come. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions of Ms. Cooper? Okay.
Thank you. We have two more brief witnesses. Tom Peterson from Farmers Union.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union. We appreciate the efforts of Senator Marty to make this legislation more palatable to the Farmers Union. With the amendments added in the committee today, it does do that for us. And we've dropped our opposition to the bill and are now supportive of the legislation. We were originally opposed to it. I didn't even attend the first couple of hearings of the bill. We started to get involved in it because we had some concerns, and our members were wondering how it might affect truck usage on the farm and wanted to make sure those are available. But we see that certain trucks are exempt from this, and other trucks we feel will be available. We did, however, then get involved because of ethanol, and we had some concerns about ethanol usage. And a lot of our members have significant investments, of course, in ethanol and corn, and so that's very important to our members. And we started to work with some of the rural members of the legislature in the House that wanted to do something with the bill. And they said, are you just outright opposed to the bill, or can we work on it and make it better? And we chose the latter. And the reason we did is we started to meet with our members, as we do, and we started to hear from them. In fact, the first meeting I went to, and I started to talk about why we were opposed to this bill, and the first guy told me, he said, why? He said, did you happen to notice when you drove into town today that gas was $3.50 a gallon? And he said, you know, a lot of our members, they like to both farm full-time and their families, but one person drives to the Mayo Clinic or Schwann's or Polaris, and you're driving an hour for an extra job. And so that's the way it is in a lot of rural areas. And so there's a lot of interest in challenging the auto industry to drive, to build more cleaner, efficient cars, which we believe the passage of this bill will do. The other thing I thought was kind of interesting is that it was on TV, the first hearing in the House Ag Committee, and the testimony was you're not going to be able to buy a Lincoln Town Car. And the one guy said, you know, at $4 a gallon, I don't want to buy a Lincoln Town Car. I got to get something that works. And I hope Farmers Union, that's not your main concern. So we started to dig in a little bit and look at what we could do for this legislation. The result of that is the amendments that was added to the bill. We are a strong supporter of ethanol E85. But we believe that this legislation could actually have the ability to increase ethanol sales and awareness. The studies and reports in this legislation now lay the framework to helping measure progress and outcomes for E85 and the impacts on ethanol. And you see that with measuring, and I think you've heard that. I'm not going to go into that, how we measure E85 and how we're doing its usage. We had concerns about handing over our state laws to California. But the more we've looked at it, the more and fuel prices and everything is encouraged us to move forward. We visited at length with the California Air Resources Board and talked to them about our concerns about this, and I directly asked them if this was going to have an impact on ethanol or not. And their answer to me is absolutely not. They don't see why it can't encourage them. We talked with our California Farmers Union. They're very excited about the E85 and ethanol moving into their state. They know that they only have three pumps. And or this was earlier in the year, but I just looked online, and they put in a $5 million investment, as Minnesota has invested into getting their E85 pump structure up. We're at E10. They need to move to E10. They're at about E5, almost E6. And so they're moving forward with their ethanol and usage. They've also put $125 million into ethanol in infrastructure to move ethanol, because one of the problems is California is a big state, and you might have a pump in San Diego and Sacramento, and how do you get it there efficiently? So that was a real big problem. So those are a lot of things that we're working on. A couple of other quick points. One more quick point. We also talked about, shouldn't this be handled at a national level? And that's good, too. We support that, and we're pushing that at a national level. We know that one way or another, we're going to have a new president, whether it's President Obama or President Clinton. But also if we have a President McCain, I think we can all agree that President McCain has been a really a different kind of senator on these issues. And so keep in mind that this bill now delays the implementation date to 2009. So you're looking at automobiles for 2013. And what's the price of fuel going to be in 2013? And what did we do now to have an impact on that outcome in the future? So I urge your consideration. Thank you.
Thank you.
Finally, we have Molly Schultz for some very quick comments.
Good morning. Welcome, everyone, to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Molly Schultz. I am the Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Environmental Partnership. I'm here today on behalf of our coalition of more than 80 conservation and environmental organizations throughout the state, representing nearly 500,000 Minnesotans. Each year, our members choose a few issues that we believe rise to the level of having the full force of our coalition behind their passage. We call it our priority or collaborative agenda. This year, our members chose Senator Marty's bill, the Lower Vehicle Emission Standards. When we choose our issues, one of the things we do is gauge public support. MEP found through our polling and focus groups conducted this fall that the adoption of these standards is a no-brainer for most Minnesotans. Our statewide poll showed that over 75% of Minnesotans believe that these regulations are an important step towards reducing global warming pollution and that they are necessary to increase pressure on manufacturers to produce more efficient cars. This support cut across party lines, it cut across demographics such as age and gender, and it cut support levels were similar throughout the state geographically. We conducted focus groups of residents of the Austin and Albert Lea area, and also in the western suburbs of Eden Prairie, Chanhassen, and Chaska. These were ordinary people selected by an independent marketing firm, not members of ours or a self-selected group of enviros. Again, we found strong support across all demographics and party lines. The prevailing sentiment was they should have done this a long time ago. Participants also recognized that automakers have a long history of dragging their heels when it comes to producing more fuel-efficient cars that pollute less. Over and over, we heard members of our focus group say, particularly in the Albert Lea area, they aren't going to do it on their own. You have to make them do it. I come from an auto dealer family. My late grandfather purchased his first auto dealership in 1942 and expanded to several lots before selling them in the late 60s. My father recently retired after 45 years of selling cars and managing dealerships. I am particularly sensitive to things that may hurt this sector of the economy because it's what put food on my family's plate. But while I grew up defending my father from used car salesman jokes, I also grew up with his healthy skepticism of auto manufacturers. And it turns out that this skepticism is pretty well justified based on where the claims are coming from in their attempts to defeat this bill. Representatives of the auto dealers and the machinists were in here the other day and predicted that this bill would kill the auto business in Minnesota, causing dealerships to close and causing massive job losses. Where do they get this information? They must be getting it from the manufacturers because they're not getting it from their own members. I have a story here that was reported on WCCO last Friday. It says the people are flocking into Walzer Toyota Scion, a car dealership in Bloomington. It says they're having no trouble getting people in their door lately because everybody is trading in their SUVs and their pickup trucks. They're downsizing to smaller, more fuel-efficient cars, and they're willing to pay more money. This is WCCO. Already by their own admission, the market is drastically and perhaps permanently changing here in Minnesota. And even though cars with these standards won't be on the lot for 5 more years, the dealers and the machinists were confidently advocating the manufacturer's position that this will negatively impact auto sales. But we have to ask ourselves, can we really trust the manufacturers? Because if they had that kind of crystal ball, why didn't they look into it 5 years ago and save the Ford plant? Representatives of the auto manufacturers came to your committee the other day to assure you that the production of Minnesota's ethanol industry was a top priority for them. We find that claim to be disingenuous at best. In fact, the auto industry has historically been against Minnesota's efforts to grow our ethanol market. An example, they have opposed our E20 mandate since Senator Dallas Sams first introduced the bill in 2005, before a single drop of E20 had been produced and before a single test had been conducted. The industry declared E20 a failure, vowed to fight Minnesota's ethanol advocates in Washington, D.C. General Motors Vice Chairman Bob Lutz said, and this is a direct quote, "We absolutely guarantee the destruction of the engine and the fuel injection system if we go the E20 route." Not a shred of evidence to back it up, but that's the claim they took to Washington to try to defeat Minnesota. Unlike the auto industry, the Minnesota Environmental Partnership has been working hard to make Minnesota a leader in alternative fuels. 2008 is the second year in a row that we have advocated on behalf of a comprehensive biofuels program. Simply put, if we believed the Clean Cars legislation would in any way interfere with the development of alternative fuels, we would not be supporting it. We believe that Senator Marty's bill will encourage Minnesota's developing alternative fuel market, and it's not based on what the California Air Resources Board says. It's because they put their money where their mouth is. Minnesotans need you to see beyond the manufacturer's attempt to make this confusing and difficult. The bottom line is this bill is telling them to do what they should be doing anyway, and that's make better car parts. They're saying they can't. They're saying they can't, and their arguments may have some merit if they weren't based on the same campaign of fear and misinformation that the industry uses to fight every environmental and safety regulation. Minnesotans are getting sick of seeing Detroit post record losses each quarter. We're getting sick of hearing about plant closings and worker layoffs in our own backyard and across the country. We know that these things aren't happening because environmental extremists are forcing Detroit to make clean, fuel-efficient cars. What happened to American ingenuity? When did American companies start hiring expensive lobbyists and lawyers and marketing companies to fight progress, instead of hiring engineers and mechanics to develop and build new technology that keeps Minnesota, keeps America as a global leader in manufacturing? Minnesotans need you to see beyond the hysterical claims of the manufacturers, their inflated costs, and their desperate rhetoric. It's one thing to label me and my members as extremists, as they do on their website. I'm kind of used to it. But there's no way to pin that label on the governor's handpicked task force on climate change who recommended these standards, or on the Republican governor of Florida who adopted them by executive order. And moreover, you can't pin the extremist label on the Minnesotans who know that there is nothing extremist about wanting to drive cars that pollute less. There is nothing extremist about reducing our dependency on foreign oil by driving more fuel-efficient cars, because that is just plain Minnesota common sense. Thank you for your time this morning.
You said you surveyed ordinary people in Albert Lee. And
we did.
We knew they were all ordinary people. Senator Sparks, I...
Easy.
No comment. We thank you that they're ordinary. No, we understand that. Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, I think Senator Sparks thinks they're extraordinary.
Right. There you go. You put to exactly what he was thinking, yes. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to have about 10 minutes or so from the opponents that we didn't get to last, whenever we met a couple days ago. I've got Mr. Stockman from the Corn Growers, Valerie Jurich from the Ethanol Producers, and Mr. Workman from Abate. So, welcome to the Minnesota Senate.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for giving us the opportunity to speak today. I'm Roger Moore, president of Minnesota Corn Growers Association.
Roger Moore. Excuse me, yeah, we got the wrong name on my... Okay, Mr. Moore.
Yeah. We kind of like to tag team. Mr. Stockman will kind of work together on this. I represent 6,000 corn growers throughout the state of Minnesota. And with me today is Bruce Stockman. He's executive director of the Minnesota Corn Growers Association. As Minnesota corn growers, we have been and still are in support of cleaner emissions from our vehicles and motorized equipment. We have and continue to be supporters of clean burning fuels. We have and continue to be supportive of locally produced fuels from renewable sources. Our state implementation program, as part of the Federal Clean Air Act requirement, is suited for our environment and will continue to be superior to California standards for our needs. We have different climate and different fuels. If the California standards for vehicles is adopted, will that mean we must also adopt their fuel requirements to achieve California emission standards here in Minnesota? Minnesota already has much cleaner air than California. We have improved our air quality utilizing the federal requirements in our state implementation program, of which ethanol blended fuels has been a critical part. We don't want to do anything to jeopardize that. The graduating improvements of the federal requirements along with our state implementation program have and will continue to keep us in the lead with cleaner emissions from our vehicles and increased ethanol use. This benefits Minnesotans to a greater degree rather than exclusively benefiting oil interests from outside of the state and country. The current Minnesota requirements help us utilize greater percentages of domestic renewable fuels than we would under California requirements. The California testing requirements for the vehicles and the California required testing fuel work together against both the greater use of ethanol and, in particular, E85. We have worked hard and invested a lot of corn growers' money to enjoy the improved utilization of our homegrown renewable fuels, and we see no reason to adopt California standards when doing so jeopardizes the progress we've already made. The fact still remains that California has several of the most polluted cities. Why follow them when Minnesota is already in the lead? Additionally, California has among the highest gasoline prices in the country. A study commissioned by the oil industry has indicated that ethanol is keeping the price at the pump at least 15% lower than it would otherwise be. As an elected official, I would not want to have voted for something that would increase the cost of gasoline. As a Minnesota elected official, why would you give up some of your authority to California-appointed bureaucrats? Adopting this California standard into law would definitely increase the cost for consumers with both equipment and testing required by some $1,000 to $3,000 per vehicle. We believe this bill would limit the amount of ethanol sold and therefore eventually increase the price of gasoline at the pump. I urge you to vote against SF 481.
Mr. Stockman, I didn't see you there at first. Welcome. I know who you are. Good to see you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I may, I'd like to speak just briefly to the amendments. And noticing on page 5 towards the bottom, number item 9, it says whether the flex fuel vehicles are tested on gasoline grades sold in Minnesota. One of the problems that we have is that the testing procedure in California uses a different base fuel. And the base fuel's differences in how they test are actually at a disadvantage for ethanol results. They use MTBE as part of the base fuel in the mix for testing standard vehicles. For flex fuel vehicles, they have testing using E10 rather than E85. I noticed in the comments on the Hummer that that's assuming that it's running on E85. Current requirements for the testing procedure don't let you test using E85 for E85 or flex fuel vehicles. I noticed also that the amount of savings for carbon in the form of tons, if each vehicle running on E85, flex fuel vehicle that we had in Minnesota, we'd have over 700,000 tons of carbon not in the environment each year. Each vehicle averages about 4 tons of savings from carbon being emitted into the air if the average miles is run on each of the flex fuel vehicles that we have in the state. Our interest would be to require the autos to make all their vehicles eventually flex fuel so that we could all have that savings. We are not on the side of getting in bed or aligning ourselves with autos. We've had our differences with autos as well. Our interest is on behalf of the farmers and the clean air in Minnesota. Thank you.
Okay, we have just a couple more minutes. Mr. Workman or Ms. Jerry, you both want to go up there at the same time? And welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Valerie Jarek, and I lobby for the Minnesota corn growers and for the is part of that organization, the Minnesota Ethanol Producers Association. And just so you know which plants are in there, we represent the plants from several different parts of the state and a cross-section of six different plants. There's another organization that represents the balance of those plants. But I just want to not belabor all this because you've heard so much of this already from corn growers and from the people who testified in opposition to this bill. The Minnesota Ethanol Producers Association has been opposed from this from the first time we laid eyes on the bill. We did not get sucked in by the large auto manufacturers, as has been suggested. A lot of talk has been thrown out about the MCAG, the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group, which met for several months. And they say that they recommended this. Well, they did recommend this on a vote by one vote. It was not an overwhelming mandate from that climate change organization. And I printed off the internet some of the conclusions that came out of that. And one of the things that they talked about were key uncertainties of adopting the California standards. And one of them was predicting how long it will take to resolve the lawsuit over this issue is beyond the ability of the group. Clearly, the law will be in litigation for some time. You heard that the California waiver was denied by the EPA. It's in litigation. We don't know when that is going to happen, whether the new president will have the time to initially overthrow the EPA's ruling and decide to let California go ahead with this or not. California cannot even implement these standards that we're seeming to want to be willing to adopt for Minnesota. And so I think it's prudent that we wait until that lawsuit is settled. In addition, the EPA has already announced that they are going to move forward with their new rules, and that is now in the works. We don't know how the EPA rule will compare with the California rule. Nobody's done the testing. Nobody's tested vehicles that are running on our fuel standards in Minnesota to see what our needs really are. We don't even know how our current fuel with our mix of blends of ethanol would compare to the California standard or to the new EPA standard. We're going to walk into the abyss without even knowing what our problem is. And I think we're getting the cart ahead of the horse doing this. The MCAG also said there's some concern that California standards may constrain the sale of E85 vehicles due to the partial ZEV standard and the testing on worst-case fuel blends. It may require switching back to metal fuel tanks, which add weight and packaging issues. I don't think that's going to be a good idea. We're adding over $1,000 to maybe $3,000 on every new vehicle that we're asking our people in Minnesota to buy. We don't agree with that either. A couple other items that were talked about. Mr. Urkel indicated that California has gotten it right. Well, they still have seven of the top 10 most polluted cities, depending on which list you look at. For sure, that the top three are of the most polluted cities are still in California. But California is different. We'll give them that. They're surrounded on the ocean on one side, mountains on the other. They're trapped in there. They have a different issue with smog and pollutions than we do. We are not California. We don't want to be California. We have one-eighth the number of vehicles. You also heard that we only have 177,000 E85 vehicles, flex fuel vehicles in our state. They have 300 and some. Yes, but do the math. In comparison, not very many. Mr. Caquette from the CARB, we met with him. We talked about how this was all going to come down in California. He admitted that even though it had been 2.5 years since the governor signed the executive order and they applied for their waiver to the federal government that is now in court, they have only installed 3 pumps at that time that he testified about a month ago. For 300,000 vehicles, for 32 million cars, that does not give the consumers a very big option in California. They say they're moving that way in 2.5 years. You would think they would have gotten a little bit further than they have. Certainly, we are the epicenter for biofuels in this state. We think this jeopardizes what we're doing. We believe that the I just lost my train of thought here. We believe that the onerous way that the CARB is trying to figure out how to make auto manufacturers track consumers' use of E85 doesn't make any sense whatsoever. We talked to the CARB board about that, to the individual from the CARB board that we met with. They haven't worked it out yet. They say they'll do a survey. Well, in order to do a survey, that means that consumers would have to track how many gallons of E85 they're buying and how many gallons of regular fuel they're buying. I wouldn't do that, and I have an E85 vehicle. I'm not going to track that. I have enough to track for the IRS. I'll be darned if I'm going to do it for General Motors. So if I got the survey in the mail, it would go in the garbage. He said, what if it came with a dollar bill? If it came with a dollar bill, I'd take the dollar bill, and the survey would go in the garbage. He said, what if it came with $100? That's exactly who is going to absorb the $100 that you're going to give somebody to bring their car in. We think this is a privacy issue. If you try to do it on OnStar, not every car is equipped with OnStar. I have OnStar. I have to pay, I think it was $179 the last payment I had to make to keep my OnStar active for the next year. Not everybody's going to pay, even if they get a car with, equipped with OnStar, to continue that. So I think there's just lots of reasons to hunker down here and say, let's test our fuels against these standards. Let's stop and think what we're doing here. And never mind that I'm representing clients here as a private citizen. I don't want California to be the boss of me.
Okay. Mr. Workman, we are scheduled to be in session at noon, so sometimes they want me there. So,
thank you, Mr. Senator Metz. I know it was a cruel hoax being last right before lunch and session and everything else like that. Let's vote it down. I'll meet you down at Billy's on Grand. I'll be the guy with the shirt off. It's a beautiful day out there to ride a motorcycle. And I'm here representing ABATE of Minnesota, American Bikers for Awareness, Training, and Education. I hate the moniker myself. But I am not here representing manufacturers or dealers. I know a lot of dealers, good people. They are the people that are going to profit because your average motorcyclist can no longer modify their motorcycle and are going to be further in trouble with this legislation because you are going to need a computer degree to fix your own or modify your motorcycle. The industry does estimate that between $300 and $1,500 is going to be added on to a new motorcycle. And here we are, a wonderful solution to the gas crisis for at least a handful of months in the summer here. Most of us ride every month, but 50 to 100 miles per gallon on these motorcycles and machines. I'm seeing motorcycles that look like they've been in storage for 5 to 10 years and are dusty out there. People are getting creative, and they're going to be using those motorcycles. Presumably they're not affected. We do have a gentleman who's the president of St. Croix Valley Riders who runs a shop. One of these California motorcycles came in, and it was another few hundred just to get at that bike. Now, when I ride out to Sturgis every year, in the nearest next state, I think, is New Mexico, what am I going to get when I ride to Milwaukee or Sturgis for a mechanic that's going to work on my new California-dictated motorcycle? And I'll quickly wrap up. I have been told repeatedly in person and by email by the House author that, in fact, she's going to offer an amendment to this bill on the House floor to exempt motorcycles just like lawnmowers. We are not lawnmowers, but I do not believe that that it is allowed, that you can pick and choose us out of this California bill. But we've been told at least a dozen times, and that's a little bit scary to us. So, Mr. Chairman, have a vote. Vote it down. We don't want to see this pass and then wait for or have to monitor what California is doing so we'll know about this industry in the future. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. Mr. Question to Mr. Workman at this time, or
yes,
Senators? Okay,
Mr. Workman,
Senator Carlson.
I think you did hear. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Mr. Workman. You did hear that motorcycles are exempted, and you did hear. I think you've heard also that already owned motorcycles are grandfathered. So I don't know exactly what your objection is.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carlson, I've been told that they are going to be exempted in an amendment on the House floor. It's my understanding you can't pick and choose which California Air Board parts you want. Maybe I've got this wrong, Mr. Chairman, but if motorcycles can be removed sometime soon, I guess maybe we don't have a problem. But that's not my understanding of the bill.
Senator Marty, do you have a...
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, it's similar to what Mr. Workman mentioned about lawnmowers. It does not cover lawnmowers. It does not cover motorcycles. We put in the lawnmower amendment because some people were saying it was going to cover it. So we were just stating what's already in the California standards that we're picking up. California may regulate motorcycles in some way. The standards we are adopting has nothing to do with motorcycles or lawnmowers or snowmobiles or anything other than some passenger cars and light trucks.
Senator Carlson? Senator?
Mr. Chair, and I think we're probably almost time to move out of here, but I guess I'm very concerned over what I've been hearing here. Hearing an awful lot of distractions, the distraction of tracking. We already know that California has to track. They have to figure out how to track. And if they can't figure it out, it doesn't affect us. They have to figure out how to track. That's not us having to worry about it. If they can't track it, they can't do it. They can't do the... In fact, that's a federal regulation, so that really has nothing to do with what we're trying to do here. And then I'm concerned about also about this some of the testimony that we've heard before. Even on Monday, I was hearing from mechanics that mechanics jobs are going away. And after I spoke with a couple of the people that were testifying, what they were saying is that the mechanics' jobs are going to go away because dealers were going to go away, and that has nothing to do with this. If we don't sell as many cars, or if we don't repair as many cars, that might take some mechanics' jobs away. But just the mere fact of dealerships going out of business or becoming larger businesses and still selling the same number of cars or more cars will actually increase mechanics' jobs. Plus, I think one of the elements in here is potentially going to a new refrigerant. And we went from R12 to R134A many years ago. And that is still creating jobs because all cars now are 134A, and many, many cars are being converted daily to 134A. And if we go to 156, which actually has a factor that's one-tenth the greenhouse gas factor as 134A, that's another huge demand for jobs. So some of these things what I'm hearing here are really kind of disappointing. And then the issue of that we're somehow under California, we're going to be we're under California's laws. We didn't invent fuel injection. We didn't invent positive crankcase ventilation. We didn't invent 134A. We didn't invent distributorless ignitions. We didn't invent any of those things, and that's what's used today, and that's what's needed to meet today's car standards. And for us to say that, to stick our heads in the sand and say that just because we didn't invent all those things here in Minnesota, that we're not going to adopt somebody else's regulation is rather absurd. The catalytic converters were something that came from California standards also. So, and we all have them today. Or we all have some other mechanism to overcome those emissions. So I'm a car guy. I own a 40-year-old car, and I know that I have nothing to worry about because I'm going to keep driving that car for a long time, and eventually I'm going to have to put in it some minor additives to continue to drive it. Today I put in lead substitute. Today I put in the octane enhancer. So I'm going to continue to drive that old car. I don't have a motorcycle anymore, but I may again. But I don't have a problem with this kind of improvement to our engines. So I really want to see us pass this. And Mr. Chair, I'm calling for a roll call vote.
Excellent. That's fine. Any further discussion? Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. You know, I'm not going to vote for this today because of the ceding of authority to California. I want to understand that. But, you know, to the auto industry, I do want to say that I, in January, I bought a pickup like this. I was hooked in by the red tag sale. And, you know, we at the time, anybody who was watching television would have thought the only vehicles on the lot were flex fuel. I mean, it was everywhere. They were advertising this. There was one flex fuel vehicle on the lot that I was looking at. And, you know, if you were going to buy a hybrid, which was also being advertised, I think they made 2,500 of them for the country, of which Minnesota got less than 50. So if we're going to move forward in this, you know, the auto industry's got to move forward and do what they're actually advertising. You know, the salesman never mentioned flex fuel to me, never even mentioned it as an option. And so, you know, we've got to work that way. And to the ethanol folks, the ethanol and the corn guys, you know, you're kind of in the weeds, I think, because if ethanol burns cleaner, which it does, you should want cleaner cars because people will use more ethanol. I mean, it just, I don't know what all this technical stuff and certification stuff and lawsuit stuff you're talking about is, but just on a bigger picture, if it's cleaner to burn, people will use it because you got to meet the clean standard. But we'll spend a little time thinking about this, you know, California's giving our authority to them. But, you know, long term, I think we're going to have to move this way.
Okay. Yeah, I think Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to try not to beat on the hornet's nest here too much because I think everybody's minds are made up. But I got a couple things that are eating at me, and as most people know, I'm going to speak my mind. Senator Scoy makes a good point, very good point, about how our dealers are basically hamstrung by the interests in Detroit. And, you know, our dealerships can only be as effective as what they have to deal with. And right now, they, as Senator Scoy has pointed out, they don't have much to deal with. And it's not their fault. And, you know, if we implement this bill, you know, the dealers in my district along the border are going to be negatively impacted. And I truly believe that. But I'm still going to vote for the bill. And it's for a lot of the reasons that Senator Scoy talked about, is because there's been so much inaction on this issue. And we know that 30% of all the gases that are created that lead towards global warming or increases in asthma or other lung-related illnesses come right out of the tailpipe of our vehicles. Folks, it's time to quit talking about this bill and just go ahead and pass it. And this bill is not a clean car bill. It's a cleaner car bill. Because until we get rid of the internal combustion engine, we're going to continue to have these discussions. Now, I've always been a supporter of the ethanol industry. But I can tell folks that corn-based ethanol is an industry that's headed nowhere. Right now, it's a pretty good bridge to the future. But in the future, we're not going to be using ethanol because we're not going to be using internal combustion engines. That's just the way it is. Now, how do we get here? Well, I think it's pretty obvious how we've gotten to this point with 30% of the greenhouse gases coming out of the tailpipe of automobiles. It's because of the corporate greed in Detroit and the automobile manufacturers, who, by the way, own substantial interests in companies like Exxon and, I don't know, whatever they call Shell these days. And that's one of the biggest reasons. They want to keep producing those vehicles that you bought, Senator Scoy, because it makes some money on both ends. We all know that there's a bigger markup on some of those SUVs and pickup trucks. You know, people make more money when they sell those. But I can tell you what. It's time that we quit relying so much on the internal combustion engine and move to something else. And if this bill is going to help that transformation, then I'm all for it. Am I all for California standards? Not really, Senator Marty. And I think that somebody on this side of the table had voiced their hesitancy to cede our power to another state. And I do believe that you've built things into the bill so that we could opt out on things if they became too onerous. But am I happy about that? No, but I'm gladly going to vote for it. Gladly, because it's the only game in town. And until we as a legislature at least send a strong message to the federal government to kind of get off your hands, implement standards that make sense. The European Union is moving to 49-mile-a-gallon threshold. If you can't make a vehicle that gets 49 miles a gallon, they're not going to, and that's 27 countries, and they're not going to allow those vehicles to be on the road. And here in the United States, you know, we have that huge love affair with our automobiles, and I do too, and so does Senator Day, and you know, and so does Senator Scheid. You know, we all grew up with this love affair, you know, driving in the big Buicks of yesteryear with your folks, and you know, it just you know, we've got that love affair. We've got the love affair with NASCAR and open wheel racing and motorcycles that we talked about earlier. But, you know, our love affair is leading us down a road that is going to create environmental havoc for our grandkids. And, you know, every now and again, we have to look into the future. And is a bill perfect? No, absolutely not. But once again, it's the only game in town. And now I'm going to vote for this bill, and people are going to go, oh, the auto workers are going to kill you. You know, these folks are going to kill you. Those folks are going to beat you up. Well, you know, that's okay. But, you know, when I go home this weekend and I see my grandson, I'm going to be happy about it.
Okay. Senator Bonnap, then I think we've had going on 4 hours of testimony.
Good testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will be brief because really Senator Murphy said – pretty much what I was going to say, and that is that I don't like giving our authority to California, but in fact, we have two choices. Give it to the federal government, who has not done what is required to make sure we're moving in the right direction, or this is our only option. And so I'm hopeful that if states continue to move in this direction, that that will be the message that the federal government will here, so that in fact we have a unified set of standards in this country, and that's really where we need to go, and that would solve the problem. And so if by our leadership we move in that direction, then that's a good thing. So while in principle I am concerned about that, I think overall it is the direction we ought to go.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator,
I'll be very brief also.
Okay, Senator Thomasoni, is it?
Yes,
yeah.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Thomasoni.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to vote against this because Minnesota is not California. And, you know, our air is cleaner, our climate's different, uses of our vehicles are different, our gas is cheaper, and I have absolutely no idea why I, as a legislator from Minnesota, would abdicate my ability to represent my constituents by allowing California to make our laws. And I just don't think this is the right direction to go for Minnesota, and I think if we want to pass our own laws, we can. I don't see why we would want to pass California's laws.
Senator Day.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, I feel the same way as Senator Thomasoni. Keep in mind that, first off, if Senator Carlson said there's been a lot of crazy things said. One of the crazy things is that our auto dealers in the United States have led us down the primrose path. You can buy vehicles now that are 30, 40, 50 miles per gallon. That will come. I can remember in 70 when we didn't have any gas. If you went to Florida, you would have to go out to the turnpikes to get a half a tank of gas in your car. We went through times when gas was very scarce. I will tell you, in California, they started out the same way. Then it's motorcycles, then it's boats, then it's all-terrain vehicles. Now it's dune buggies. This is just the start of what might happen. So I would have liked to ask I think it was Mr. Urkel, who was very knowledgeable. I wanted to ask him why my lilacs are 2 weeks late in blooming, because, you know, there are some things that happen that sometimes we don't all have the answer to. But I just, you know, if we want to talk about what we want done, we can go to Klobuchar, we can go to Coleman, and we got other 8 legislators that are there. We don't have to say, well, let's all get in a bus and go to California and meet with Schwarzenegger and his clean air group to find out how Minnesota. We live in a wonderful quality of life state. And our pollution, we have no pollution compared to what's happening in California. I would understand why they would start this. I mean, they've somebody mentioned the demography of the state, and geography of the state. I understand that. But I just can't see Minnesota at this stage of the game. I think we're a few years away yet, and maybe it'll come down to this. But I think for now we should regulate ourselves through the EPA.
Okay, we're going to to vote. Did you move the bill, Senator Carlson? I know you asked for a roll call, but
Mr.
why don't you move
it? Yes, I moved the bill.
Okay.
Secretary, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, did we do the amendment?
Yes, we did.
We did?
Okay. Yeah, I think Senator Scheid.
Move the bill as amended.
Okay, thank you very much.
Metzen?
No.
Bach?
No.
Bonoff?
Yes.
Carlson?
Yes.
Day?
No.
Gerlach?
No.
Gimsey?
No.
Koch?
No.
Latz?
Yes.
Michelle?
Yes.
Murphy?
Yes.
Rosen?
No.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Scheid?
Yes.
Skoy?
No.
Sparks?
No.
Tomasoni?
No.
10-7. I've got 10. By a vote, I believe 7 in favor and 10 no. The bill is not passed.
Thank you very much.
Let me make a statement that there's nobody in this room that's not for clean air and clean water and all of these things we're discussing. So we're on the same page on that, but it's the island effect and some other issues that people talked about. So.
Mr. Chairman, we'll be back next
week. So, meeting's adjourned.
For my granddaughter.
Hey, Jim, thanks for having me here.
Thank you, Jim.
We'll get there.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. We